The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock, offering care in 30 locations across northern New England and in your community. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. Dartmouth-Hitchcock.org.
And from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
Is one of you tamed and one of you untamed in this pair?
We are both completely feral. You can ask anyone.
I'll have to agree with that.
Elizabeth Marshall Thomas and Cy Montgomery's 30-plus year friendship began with a ferret bite. Cy was new to Hancock, New Hampshire back then and had just returned from following emus across the outback. Liz lived in nearby Peterborough. They got together to talk about a paper Liz co-authored documenting evidence of elephants using infrasound. So they were already kind of kindred spirits when Cy's ferret took a bite out of Liz.
I put my hand out to one of them and he bit me. And I didn't mind. I don't care if ferret bites me. But Cy was pleased because many people would have gotten hysterical and thought it had rabies and on and on and on.
Cy's quick to point out that the ferrets were born while she was away in Australia and were just being ferrets.
The first time I put my hand in the cage with the new ferrets, I just withdrew my hand and there was a weasel hanging off every finger, you know, and they drew blood. But Liz didn't mind this at all.
The moment that happened, we were good friends.
Since then, the pair of naturalists and science writers have traveled and worked together from Costa Rica to Tanzania, and for years collaborated on a column about animal behavior and research for the Boston Globe called Tamed and Untamed. Some of those essays are now collected into a book of the same name. The column could be surprisingly controversial at times.
We used to have a Q&A that went with our column. The Q&A readers would write in with their animal problems, and we would answer. And the very first Q&A that we answered was from a lady who wrote in. Her boyfriend did not like her dog because the dog barked too much. And we wrote back that we normally did not recommend euthanasia, but the boyfriend had to go.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. I sat down with the two authors and animal lovers under a maple tree at Cy's place to talk about the book and learn more about scientific findings that blur the lines between humans and their fellow creatures.
Yes, that's true.
Well, you both write about a term that you use in the book, anthropodenial. Well, anthropodenial?
Yeah.
Yeah, the word anthropodenial. It's the opposite of anthropomorphism, which means feeling about or speaking of animals or other life forms as if they had human characteristics. Anthropodenial means speaking of other life forms as if they do not have human characteristics. The word was coined by Franz de Waal, who's a famous biologist and primatologist, and I think it's one of the best words in the English language at this point.
Well, right, because both of you observe on many different occasions about the emotional lives and capacity for love, if I can say that, of animals. Now, Liz, you were telling me earlier that this is something you realized at a very young age. How did you come upon that?
Well, my family had cats, two cats, and I was born into a family with cats and a dog, and a big dog. And the big dog became my nanny, and she was a very strict nanny. She wouldn't let us go near water. We went to the beach in the summer, but she wouldn't let us swim. When she sat down and I stood up, our eyes met. We were at the same level. And it never occurred to me. I know that people genuinely believed that animals did not have consciousness, did not feel emotions or have memories. And I love to think that Cy and I, at very early ages, knew more at the time than all the scientists in the world knew. For me, it was a no-brainer from day one, and it was for Cy, too.
And so there's a lot of research and data that you both point to in your essays. Cy, I'm thinking of a couple about how human and animal biology sync, or research that you write about that shows consciousness in animals. Can you tell us about some of those?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, there is debate over what consciousness is. There is even debate over whether humans have consciousness or whether it's just made up. But if you assume the characteristics of the mind that you have and I have, if you assume that that mind is shown by behaviors that we have, such as language, such as the ability to enjoy music, such as planning, memory. When Liz was growing up, people questioned whether even chimpanzees had minds, because Jane Goodall only went into the field in 1960. And she's the one who found out that chimps, for example, wage war even like we do. We now know that there's chimps that can learn American Sign Language. We now know that there are parrots that you can ask them in English a question about the characteristics of objects on a tray, and they can describe those characteristics correctly in English. They can tell you about their innermost feelings in English. You cannot doubt that an animal like that has a mind. And what's happening now, which is so exciting, is that we're starting to see this in other animals who are much more unlike us than our chimps, who are so like us, you can get a blood transfusion from a chimp, dogs, cats, even insects. For example, you know, the monarchs that we're going to be seeing this afternoon flying all over the place. Caterpillars have memories that the butterfly can access even after everything's been reorganized in the cocoon.
Many animal lovers, they understand their dog or their cat or their chickens or their sheep. You know, there's some sense of connection. But we love some animals and don't love others. Rats, for example.
You know, rats are so excellent. I mean, we would have rats in spades if they just lived longer. It breaks your heart. Rats are great. Only recently has it been discovered that rats, for example, laugh.
Really?
If you use the right machine, you can hear rats laughing. And they laugh at the same stuff we do. They laugh when they're tickled. They love to be tickled. And they love a lot of the same things that we do. And really, you know, all of life wants what we want. You know, they want to eat when they're hungry. They want to sleep when they're tired. They want to drink when they're thirsty. They want company if they're lonely. And other times they want to be left alone. But I think that when we imagine the lives of other animals, we take with us a big bundle of our own prejudices and our own desires, and we project those onto them. And that's where we err.
I had an interesting experience. I wrote a book called The Hidden Life of Dogs, and in which I say that dogs are married and they loved each other. And someone said, how can you possibly say that dogs love each other? The word marriage was out of the question for them. They formed a permanent bond and were faithful to each other until they were parted forcibly, not by their own wish. Everybody thinks their dog loves them, but the dog can't love another dog.
So I think you said something earlier about that this is an evolutionary process, that animals have consciousness. Did I get that right?
Well, the fact that we share so much with other animals acknowledges that evolution is real. The whole idea of saying that animals have human characteristics implies that we own those characteristics, that we originated those characteristics, when in fact, it's the other way around. There was a wonderful book written a few years ago called Your Inner Fish by Neil Shubin. And basically he said people are just fish plus time. That's actually a Dilbert cartoon, but it's absolutely right. We're on the same plan as just about everybody else. But even when you deviate from that plan, which you do when you get into animals like octopuses, who are so unlike us, you know, they can taste with their skin, they have three hearts, they have blue blood, their mouth is in their armpit. even when you get to somebody who is that radically different from us and whose brain is a ring around their throat, even there, you can be friends with an octopus and they'll remember who you are. And scientists have tested this, and we know that just looking up through the water, an octopus can look at your face and know, oh, it's you again. And they like some people and don't like others. We are remarkably alike. And that's what evolution tells us. And it's also what all the creation stories tell us, that we're from the same mother or father or both. And that's where I want to be. I want to live in that moral universe. And that's a very good thing.
Let's dispel some myths, shall we? One, human beings innately dislike snakes.
Yeah, you'd think that might be the case. And we can learn very rapidly to dislike snakes. But we do learn it. We're not born with it. And there have been experiments that show that. You can, for example, I mean, it would be immoral to do this experiment today, but it has been done. A certain experimenter tried to teach small children to be afraid of different things, and you could teach a child to be afraid of a flower. But it takes longer to teach the child to be afraid of the flower than it does to teach that child to be afraid of the snake or a spider. And there's good evolutionary reason for that, because we arose in Africa, where there are a number of arboreal snakes that will climb the tree that you're sleeping in because you are a monkey and eat you or kill you. So, you know, it's good to kind of have a built-in way to quickly learn that a snake or a poisonous spider can be a problem.
Chickens are smart. Another myth busted, this idea that chickens are not, they're kind of stupid. Another discovery that hits you very personally, that disabled animals should be put down. They're not going to live a good life.
Oh my gosh. And Liz can talk about that too. Yeah. Our puppy Thurber, who's now 2 years old, we have him because he has one good eye and one blessed eye. He was born blind in one eye.
Is that why you called him Thurber?
Yes. Because James Thurber, after whom he is named, also had one blind eye, although he was not born with it. There's tons of animals who can live beautifully with any disability, just like people can live beautifully with any disability. And I think it's because people don't want to see disabled animals that this must be why we think that they're better off dead. But Liz, you can really speak to the disability issue.
Yeah, you know, I wonder if it's also that you think an animal born out in the wild without two front paws might not live.
That's perfectly true. If you're born with a disability as an animal, your chances are not as good. But most animals want to live. Another thing is we want to put them out of their misery, so to speak. That is because we have a very interesting reaction to pain, which is very severe. And pain is to us the worst thing. And we want to save the animal from experiencing pain. In front of my house, a man ran into a bear with his truck and injured the bear. And he wanted the police to come so they could examine the truck and give him an insurance report. The bear didn't go very far, and they wanted to shoot the bear. And I wouldn't let them. It was my land. And I said, they said it's not, the policeman said it's not your bear. And I said, no, but it's my land, and you're not walking on it without go see a judge and get a search warrant. And so he didn't, and the bear lived. And I saw him years later. He was huge. He had a limp on one side. Okay, he was alive. He'd lived several years, at least 4 years by that time. I mean, my daughter is disabled. She was disabled in an accident, tractor accident. And I mean, if she was a dog, we'd say, oh, well, we'll put her out of her misery and shoot her. Well, she's had a long, successful career and a happy marriage, and she was fine. And so I think that we have a very different standard for ourselves than we do for animals. And that's wrong, really. That's wrong.
You write about a black bear that comes to visit your house, eat out of your bird feeder. And I think what happens if a lot of people see that or see a fisher cat or something, they react in fear. What is a different way? What is a different response for that?
I don't know. I mean, don't be afraid. Katie Payne, the same woman that discovered infrasound in elephants, she was in Etosha Park in Namibia. She was trying to record a lion roaring. And she was lying beside the fence that encloses the tourist area. But there was a huge hole in the fence. She looked up, and a lion, a large male lion in beautiful health, was sitting within reach. He could have reached her. She met his eyes and kept her eyes on his eyes all night long, and she didn't move. And the lion, when morning came, I mean, almost 12 hours of not moving, the lion got up. Oh, while he was watching her, he drooled. he got up and walked off in the bushes, and she got up and went back to the camp, and she heard this horrible scream, and the lion had killed a kudu, so he was hungry. He just walked off, but he didn't eat her. She wasn't prey to him.
So if you act like prey, you become prey?
Well, certainly that. I mean, in the book, I say, roll a tennis ball across the floor and see what your cat does. It's definitely an invitation. And the bushman told us how to behave if you encounter a lion when you're walking in the veld. Just be casual. Walk away at an oblique angle. Just show him you're not interested in him. You're just going your own way.
I used to have a pretty unnuanced vision of hunters here in New Hampshire growing up here. And now I found that a lot of people who do hunt are actually conservationists, that they're dedicated to supporting the wildlife and the environment that we have here that produces animals. And I wondered, you know, from both of you, where you stand on that, this idea that one can both kill animals and care about them and care about the environment they live in.
Well, my mother was a hunter. She hunted squirrels and ate them in Arkansas. And a lot of my friends are hunters. I mean, I've had cats who would kill a vole like that, you know. A lot of birds would really like to be hunters, and some are. Shrikes are predatory songbirds, and a lot of the animals that we write about are hunters, and I'm not going to judge them. But, on the other hand, I've been a vegetarian for well over 30 years, and I know that we can make a choice not to kill animals to live, so that's one of the things that I do. And I also do it because it's an important way to fight global warming, so that's why I'm a vegetarian, but lots of my friends aren't. And there are many other serious conservation and humane problems out there that we need all kinds of people to fight. So when they're coming to my house, I'm going to make them a delicious meal, but there won't be any meat.
What do you think people most misunderstand about animals?
I think people do not understand that they love their lives like we do, and that their lives have value and meaning, whether we know them or meet them or not.
What do you think people most misunderstand about animal lovers?
You mean about people who love animals or animals who are your lovers?
Boy, Liz. You're going to be in so much trouble after this, aren't you?
Let's see. You know, the heck with them. I don't know.
There's really nowhere to go from there.
That was the pretty much incorrigible Elizabeth Marshall Thomas and Cy Montgomery. They are authors together of a new collection of essays called Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters of the Animal Kind. And they'll be doing readings and events around the state and other places. Gibson's Bookstore in Concord on October 14th. That's today, Saturday at 2 o'clock. The Peterborough Town Library in Peterborough on October 17th. Norwich Bookstore in Norwich, Vermont on October 25th. And the 92nd Street Y in New York City on December the 7th. There's more information at wordofmouthradio.org. One of New Hampshire's most beloved and famous residents is the moose, a giant mammal somehow able to straddle the line between majestic and absurd looking, what with their big blunt noses and comparatively spindly legs. Beloved or not, moose are not always easy to spot. Our Olling in New Hampshire series sets out to answer questions submitted by you to nhpr.org. This one comes from Sean, who asks, where is the best place to look for moose? Producer Taylor Quimby is on the case.
Go to any New Hampshire gift shop and you're bound to find moose plastered on keychains, sweatshirts, shot glasses. But let's face it, they're a little more impressive in person. So it's safe to say you probably see moose in your role.
I do.
Christine Rines is head of the Moose Project at New Hampshire Fish and Game. But it's still a big deal. Like, you still...
Oh, it's always... I mean, are you kidding? I love to see moose and sit and watch them.
She says if you want to see a moose, head up to the northernmost part of the state in Coos County, find a young, growing patch of recently clear-cut woods, and wait. Could you wait all day and see nothing?
Oh, absolutely. So the first thing you want to do is see if there are fresh tracks and droppings, and then you want to be there primarily at dusk and dawn.
Now, if crouching in a clear cut, being eaten alive by mosquitoes, isn't your idea of a day well spent, you could also head towards the Whites, to Bear Notch Road, off the Kankamagus Highway. That's where Christine tells me you'll find a moose lick. Is a moose lick like a, is that the name for a place that moose like to hang out?
Well, you know, we use a lot of road salt on our roads in the wintertime, and it washes off the roads and accumulates in the dirt. Moose find these areas and use them as an important source of sodium.
Christine says those side-of-the-road salt licks are a pretty good bet from June through August. But if you really want to up your chances, you'll probably need to get out of the car.
I always suggest everybody, if you want to see wild game, you just got to get out and walk.
Keith Robarge is a wildlife guide with Northern New Hampshire Guide Services.
Cows do that to get the bulls to come in.
Which means he's got his work cut out for him. New Hampshire's moose hunt starts on October 21st. Fish and Game only issued 51 permits this year, down from 72 in 2016.
You know, it changes all the time. New Hampshire still has, I believe, a very healthy moose population. It's just you have to work a lot harder for it. There's no more driving up the road and looking off to the side.
Dennis Witcher is another hunting guide. He says he's mostly given up work with moose clients in favor of guiding elk and duck hunts in other parts of the country. Like the others, he says the days of craning out your car window are mostly over.
Yeah, you used to be able to drive the roads and see 20 or 30 a day. Now, if you go, you know, I go in the backwoods, climb the mountains, you can see 10 moose a day if you walk, you know, 5 to 8 miles a day.
What Keith calls a healthy population is officially on the decline. I asked Christine Rines at Fish and Game whether the hunt has anything to do with that downward trend. She says no. The real culprit is climate. Warm winters have brought twin threats for moose. Less snow means more ticks, which are especially tough on calves. Less snow also means white-tailed deer are ranging further north. And they've infected moose with a parasite called brainworm. Harmless to deer, but fatal to moose.
All of the best information we have, the best scientific information, is telling us that we're going to be eventually like West Virginia. And moose can't survive in that kind of climate.
If the future of New Hampshire moose is very uncertain, what does that say to you in terms of the fact that we also have it as a kind of symbol of a part of our identity as a state and as a region?
Well, I grew up in New Hampshire, and so did my parents, and so did their parents before them. And, you know, the way New Hampshire is going to look is going to be so different. Maple trees, they won't be doing very well. Our state bird will probably no longer be here. So it breaks my heart.
For now, though, there's still plenty of moose and maple trees in New Hampshire's gift shops, and some in the woods, if you're willing to search and wait. For Only in New Hampshire, I'm Taylor Quimby.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
There's something so freeing, not staying or leaving.
Liz Longley admits to being an oversharer. It's a quality that you might not always find attractive in a friend, but a pretty good one for a singer-songwriter. The Berklee College of Music graduate continues her fierce candor on a new album called Weightless. It's a collection of intensely personal songs, infidelity, a messy breakup, and plenty of yearning, like this one, Swing. She's playing at the Tupelo Music Hall in Derry on Friday, October 20th, and Liz Longley joins us now from, actually, where are you today, Liz?
I'm in Nashville today, and I will be in Indianapolis in a few hours.
So you are on tour.
Yes.
Well, the names of these songs, as you look through them, Rescue My Heart, Never Really Mine, You Haunt Me, some pretty heavy songs. So did you just get in there and dig around your psyche pretty soon after a breakup?
You know, yeah, I mean, I wrote Weightless. That was the first song I wrote for this record, and I actually wrote it after I had just hung up the phone with my ex-boyfriend, and I was driving around on tour in L.A., just me in a rental car, and I just started singing that out loud, that I want to be weightless on top of the world. I want to be weightless on top of the world. I want to be weightless. Don't want to be anybody's lover, girl. And I didn't want to feel weighed down anymore by, you know, we were fighting over who was going to get what out of our breakup because we had lived together for a couple years. I always refer to what we went through as a divorce in training, because when you live together, you get furniture together and you get a dog together, and you have to try to figure out who gets what, and it's never an easy process. And I really felt like at the end of the day, we were fighting over material things, not the dog, obviously, but the material things. And it kind of put things in focus again and made me realize that's not what is important, and just to kind of let it go. And so, yeah, that's where it started, with that song, Weightless.
Who got the dog?
I did. She's my whole world. She's 5 years old now, and she's a beautiful little golden lab. Her name's Stella. She's actually sitting on the couch next to me right now.
Well, glad for that. But, you know, there's a kind of perspective here. It's not just the cries from the heart and a realization of the role that we play in destruction, in the destruction of relationship. There's a song on the record called What's the Matter? Let's hear a little bit of that.
We can't keep going on like this. It's wearing us down. I know you're feeling it, you just won't say it out loud. But it's always on my mind, 'cause it's just a matter of time. So what's the matter with me?
What's the matter? That's from Liz Longley's new record called Weightless. Liz, that sounds like it has a really 90s vibe to it. What were you listening to back then?
You know, that's funny. I actually wrote that song while in the process of making the record. Every other song I had already written before going into the studio, but I spent 3 months in the studio with Bill Reynolds, who's an incredible producer, and we were really kind of channeling some of my favorite 90s singer-songwriters like Alanis Morissette and Sheryl Crow, and I feel like this song really shows those colors. But I actually wrote this during the process because I was in another relationship and kind of trying to figure out what was the matter with me and him and us. And so it's a really raw song, and it's a deep cut on the record, but one that I still love performing the most because it was just so real. It just kind of poured out, and we recorded it that week.
What that's like for you, going back to these songs and playing them night after night on tour, when you've really moved on, I'm guessing, in some ways.
Yeah, it is really strange. Some nights I really feel like it just brings it all back to the surface, and other nights it feels really healing. So it just kind of depends on what I'm going through at the time, but it's almost like reliving these things on a nightly basis. But it's okay. It's kind of a reminder of what I've been through, and I absolutely love getting to share those experiences because I feel like it connects me to people and shows you, like, we all go through this stuff. It's part of the human experience, and it's part of talking about it is what can connect us and show us that, you know, you're not alone when you go through this kind of stuff.
Well, so you don't feel guarded at all about that?
No, I feel like that's the best part of it, is sharing it and knowing that it's okay to share it. And, you know, sometimes my favorite part of the show is meeting people afterwards and just saying, hearing them say, like, that song is my life. Like, you wrote my story. And that's what's so great about being so open, is knowing that other people are finding healing in it after you have.
All right, but let's get to true confessions here. Not everybody has been a drum major in the school marching band, and that was your story.
Oh, no. How did you find that?
Is there anything less cool than that?
No. Hey, I never said I was cool. I was a total drum major nerd, band for life, totally. That is me.
Has this been part of your dream, you know, to perform, to play music?
I started writing songs when I was 14, and I was a really, really shy kid, but I just loved singing, loved music. My dad is very musical. My grandfather was an army band leader. My mom always wanted to be a singer. So music really runs in both sides of my family and was always encouraged. And I played piano when I was young, and that's when I started writing music at 14. And I played it out at my ninth grade chorus concert, my first original song, and I got a standing ovation. And as strange as it seems, like, at that moment I knew this is what I want to do. This is how I want to feel connected to people. And I was really lucky to have my parents' full support, never a doubt in their mind that this was what I was going to do too. So
wow, you were hooked.
I was hooked, yeah. And honestly, the drum major thing only happened because when I was in ninth grade, I was really bummed because I couldn't be part of the band because I didn't play any instrument like that. I only played piano. And so my dad said, well, if you study really hard this summer and play clarinet every single day, you can maybe get in the band. And so I was just addicted to it. And so I was first chair I tested in because I was so nervous and I just studied all summer. Anyway, and then that wasn't enough. I had to be drum major. That was really fun too.
So you ever pull out the clarinet on tour?
I don't. But the cummerbund is tempting. It's very sparkly and flattering. No, it's not flattering at all.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the song called Rescue My Heart.
Without you, come down. Rescue my heart, I'm deep underground. I can't dig my way out, so come down. Rescue my heart. Rescue my heart. I can't breathe any faster. All the air I wanna capture. It's heavy and it hurts my head. If you found me, would you save me? If you touched me, would it break me? And will I come back from this? Come down.
Rescue. Liz Longley, Rescue My Heart. The album is called Weightless. Okay, so like the old blues song say, the best cure for a love gone wrong is a new one. I hear you have a new love in your life.
No, I actually don't.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know where you heard that, but it would be awesome.
I guess it'll only be a matter of time.
You know what? It's strange. I like having a companion. Like my life is busy and fun. It's adventurous. I'm always going somewhere. I'm always doing something. But I'm in this rare phase of my life where I am really content. I'm almost 30 and I'm just really okay right now with being alone and being extremely creative. I'm in a phase where I'm writing a lot and it's just a really fun time. So I can't complain.
The contentment sounds good, but you know, there's always this argument that darkness, despair, even a little melancholy make for better songs. Are you ready to leave that behind?
I am. I've always been of that thinking too, that, you know, you have to be going through something to write something important. And I really have just broken past that mentality recently and am just able to write from an honest place. And, you know, I've I've had enough breakups, I think, to last me a lifetime, so I'm good. I think I have the well of inspiration waiting for me at all times. So, yeah, I don't think you have to be heartbroken to write from a deep place. I'm a new believer in that.
Liz Longley, her new album is called Weightless. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And you can hear more from the album and find out more about her show at the Tupelo Music Hall in Derry on Friday, October 20th. All that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Our show today was produced by Taylor Quimby with Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, and Ben Henry. Maureen McMurray is director of Windchime Mitigation and Removal. Music in this episode from Blue Dot Sessions, Jason Leonard, and Liz Longley. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us. Civics 101 is coming up after the break.